Let's try that again. Welcome to the No Illusions podcast. My name's Cameron Riley. You're on the podcast network, and I'm on my back deck doing a podcast once again with my partner, the lovely Christine Fiddle Girl. And our guest recently moved to Brisbane from Sydney, Professor Hugo Sharp. Welcome back to the show, Hugo. I just looked up the last time you were on the old G'day World podcast, as it was once known. Was the 22nd of December 2006.
Six?
So 3.5 years ago. Three and a half years ago. So, you know, welcome back. Don't be a stranger.
No.
We've just had dinner. Christine played some violin. We're smoking Podomo Lot 23 cigars. And the first story I wanted to talk about tonight is something that I saw a couple of weeks ago, April 7th. The trial of two Russian men accused of chopping up a 16-year-old girl and eating her with potatoes has been postponed after a juror fell ill looking at prosecution images. Maxim Golovatsik and his friend florist Yuri Mozhnov, both 20, are accused of drowning Karina Baruchin in a bath and then carving up her body and serving her meat with potatoes to a lodger. Karina was in love with Mr. Golovatsik and stayed the night, the lodger said. The lodger says, Maxim and Karina went to the bathroom together and I went to bed. I was sleepy but heard splashes of water and some noise there but was not worried. Sometime later I woke up and decided to check what was going on. I went to the bathroom but Yuri stopped me on the way and told me to go back to bed. They had joked earlier that they could kill Karina, but of course I couldn't believe for a second that they were serious. Next day, when she got home from work, Mr. Golovatsik and Mr. Mozhnov offered Karina meat and potatoes. She allegedly ate it, not knowing where it was from. The men later hid the rest of Karina's remains in garbage skips, it is alleged. They cut up the body of the victim into several pieces, eating some of them and throwing the others into the bin. They cooked her meat and served up the meal with potatoes. This is my favorite bit. They were interrogated and explained the murder by saying they were desperate to eat. They confessed their guilt straight away, said the head of the St. Petersburg police. They explained they were hungry and drunk. Because, you know, we've all been there. We've all got hungry, all got drunk, had the munchies, and then gone, I know what, I'm going to cut up my girlfriend and eat her with potatoes.
You might do that.
Mixing up the starches and the proteins, not such a good idea. You know, it's from a food combining perspective.
Are you kidding? That's a classic, potatoes.
So the question I was asking Chrissy, Hugo, after I read this was, if I paid you $1 million to kill somebody and eat them, could you do it?
And I said no. $1 million is nothing anymore.
It's a lot of money.
It's not $1 million, you know, like when a millionaire was all special.
If you can hear that weird noise in the background, if it's coming through the mic.
Bats.
There are fruit bats. We may have some possums fighting with us too at any stage, and there's cars going past every now and again. Hugo, what would it take for you to... Because you're a recent vegetarian, last couple of years, on moral grounds, you said?
2 years. Well, I'd say it's moral grounds, but I guess to sum it up best, I just ran out of justification to eat meat.
Right.
And where to start on that? We can bring out some of that as we talk about this case, because I think it's kind of relevant.
What would it take for you to eat meat?
Well, yeah,
a human.
Your initial question, I see, is two questions. The first bit was murder, and then the next bit is eating human. The murder bit, you know, obviously, well, I don't know about obviously, but that bit I wouldn't do. But eating the human, $1 million, yeah, why not?
So you wouldn't murder somebody under any circumstances?
What if you didn't murder them? That's easy.
If they consented to me eating them, and I probably would eat them. Because my vegetarianism, I ran out of... justification to eat meat because I wouldn't eat human. Well, sorry, because I wouldn't eat certain things, then I feel that I don't have a justification to eat anything.
Fish? Do you do fish?
No.
No. Clams?
See, the
oysters?
Yeah, it gets down to where you set the bar.
Yeah.
And I guess I don't eat things that have hopes and dreams and aspirations and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Oysters don't know.
Well, yeah, so...
How do you know?
I mean, I think...
I'm serious.
Yeah, that's where it gets tough to know whether they do or they don't. So, obviously, I mean, dogs and that sort of thing, I mean, they have hopes and dreams. They pine when you're away. I mean, they're hoping and looking forward to you coming back. They certainly feel pain. Pain's the common one, I guess, for vegetarians. They don't want to cause anything pain. But, I mean, if you can top someone without them ever knowing, then they're not going to really feel pain. But I quite like life, and I would hate to think of extinguishing that phenomenon of life that does have things similar to me, like hopes, dreams, aspirations, networks, friend networks.
Vegetables, other people would miss them. Vegetables and fruits are alive.
Yeah, but they're...
Not sentient?
Yeah.
As far as we know?
I guess it comes to... Well, and even then, I don't know if it's just sentience or not. For me, it is that sort of... And what I'm going to say is those human qualities, but I hate to use that term. So I don't really see a separation between humans and the larger, more sentient
animals.
We're all
animals.
So getting back to the question, you would eat a human if they consented to it?
No, so, and then you...
You actually sounded like you were looking forward. You'll go, yeah, I would.
Well,
yeah. You got a little bit excited.
$1
Oh, all right, this is for the money.
Sorry.
So if Chrissy said, Hugo... I really want you to eat me, which
I don't.
Got a couple of glasses of wine and, you know, good thing she's not drinking tonight. But, and I said, I'll pay you $1 million to do it. You wouldn't pause. You'd be like, yep, let's get it on.
Yeah, obviously I'd need to consult a lawyer just to make sure that I wasn't going to go to jail for it.
Come on, I just played violin for you. What?
No, if you consent, you have to consent.
So but what if I was like, eat me? Oh, not that way.
I think cannibalism is still... I think... I'm not sure if there's a statute for cannibalism on the books here, but I think in most countries, cannibalism is illegal, whether people consent or not.
Yeah, and that would be, I guess, the issue.
So we'd have to go to Papua New Guinea to do it, where I think it's illegal, where it is legal.
Actually, a guy I worked with up until 2 weeks ago is from the highlands in Papua New Guinea, and it wasn't until the late 50s that his village ever knew of an outside world.
Wow.
Because they had given up fighting, given up cannibalism, like in the late 1800s as a village decision. And then...
only in the late 1800s, they were still eating...
Well, there were still people attacking and eating them in the 50s. Like the most recent...
Oh, in the 50s?
Yeah, it was, like in the late 80s, there was a tribe that was discovered.
Wow.
But so they were surrounded by the cannibals. The cannibals were up in the highlands and they were surrounded by them. And so that formed a boundary. So they'd never gone down to the coast. They'd never gone anywhere. And so missionaries came through and found them. And so his uncle has a scar on his nose because when the missionaries came in, the tribe had given up fighting. They were being attacked pretty... quite often by another village, and they just decided to take up arms, and they were sort of heading out to have a battle, and these white people came in, and they didn't know who these people were, and they had their spears. They normally wouldn't have had, but they had their spears and that sort of thing, and one of them threw a spear at one of the white people, and the white person shot him, and he just sort of fell down, and all the other villagers looked at each other and just freaked out and ran off. And this guy's uncle was being carried by his mother in a bag, and the mother freaked out, the baby was actually hanging on a tree, and the mother ran off with everyone else, and the baby was left there for 2 nights as they hid in the villages, and when they got back, I think some small animal had taken a piece out of his nose.
Ew.
And so he's still got the scar.
Oh.
I just Googled, is cannibalism legal in Australia? And I found this question posted on Yahoo Answers, and somebody replied, knowing some Australians, I wouldn't be surprised if it's legal. I thought, that's charming.
But if people get back to... you know, it's animal kingdom's way to eat other animals. And I guess that is fine, though I think humans, I guess, have moved beyond animal kingdom, you know, traditional dog-eat-dog you know, becoming highly aware animals ourselves, and we've, I guess now that we have morals, we've moved beyond that. But yeah, if someone wants to eat animals, I'm happy for that, but I think they shouldn't draw a line. I think it's kind of an all or nothing game.
So you should be able to eat humans as well?
Well, if they consent.
Yeah.
And I think anyone that feels queasy about eating a slug or in Australia it's very insular, and people wouldn't eat goat, or a lot of people wouldn't eat
dog.
Kangaroo, yeah, dog. People are highly offended at eating dog or cat, yeah. But that's just, it's a bit like religion. It's kind of just where you grow up.
Just culture. Tradition. Yeah.
Well, so, and it's all, but cannibalism, it's in our biological code to not eat other human beings because we have to, perpetuate our species, right?
Well, no, actually, cannibalism and human sacrifice is quite common throughout much of
the
human
history. It's a way of continuing that human.
Do you think it was
in someone else? You take on their powers. In a lot of cultures, if you eat their heart, you become. If you eat the heart of a warrior,
sure. But I'm talking about like we all come from Africa type stuff. We have to perpetuate our species.
Well, I don't know, but apparently, and this is apparently controversial, so I'm going to apologize for reading this out in the first place. But apparently, there are some sources that claim that cannibalism was common amongst the Indigenous Australians. Colin Simpson, Adam in Ochre, published by Angus and Robinson in 1938, wrote, "The eating of human flesh was not practiced by the Australian native to the extent that it was by the South Sea Islander. The term cannibalism is usually taken to mean gorging on human flesh and with relish, and that seems a valid description of the cannibalism of the Melanesian indigenes of New Caledonia, who appear to have regarded man meat much as we regard the Sunday joint." You like a bit of man meat from time to time, don't you, Kristen?
True that.
"Not all cannibalism is the same in purpose. In hard summers, the newborn children were all eaten by the Kora tribe in the neighbourhood of Adelaide, according to Dr. McKinley. In 1933, I was able to talk to old men who had eaten human flesh. The chief of Yam Island described to me how he had eaten finely chopped man meat." What are you doing? Oh, the cars. "Mixed with crocodile meat at his initiation. He added that it had made him sick. The purpose, as he put it, was to make heart come strong inside. In the Wadjabulluk tribe, a couple who already had a child might kill their newborn and feed its muscle flesh to the other one to make it strong. The baby was killed ritually by striking its head against the shoulder of its elder brother or sister. Human flesh eating among many tribes was a sign of respect for the dead. At the Dieri burial," okay, well, that's something we haven't talked about, eating. I mean, if food is scarce and a human dies by natural causes,
well, I was about to say, I don't think, by the definition you just described of cannibalism, I don't think the Donner Party, for example, could be classified as such.
The Donner Party?
You don't know about the Donner Party?
Richard Donner, the director of Lethal Weapon, did he have something to do with it? What's the Donner Party?
Oh my God, really?
Is this a party you went to once that you haven't told me about?
No! Okay. Look it up, Wikipedia, that shit. What? I swear there have been movies made about it too.
The Donner Party, sometimes called the Donner Reed Party, was a group of American pioneers who set out for California in a wagon train. Oh, American history. Like, I know anything about American history.
But this is very famous.
"Delayed by a series of mishaps, they spent the winter of 1846 and 47 snowbound in the Sierra Nevada. Some of the immigrants resorted to cannibalism to survive, eating those who had succumbed to starvation and sickness." Huh. Oh, Utah and Salt Lake City, Salt Lake Desert. Oh, were they Mormons?
No.
No?
Hang on. What about the world's biggest ritual performed by Catholics and a lot of other...
Yeah, eating
the flesh of Jesus.
Jesus. I mean, that's
pseudo-cannibalism.
That
right?
is.
They're absolutely. Trying to be cannibals. Mm. It's fucked up.
There's a good Mr. Deity episode.
Yes.
About that.
I love Mr. Deity.
They enact that ritual and then all of a sudden the Jesus and character like, starts feeling his pain.
I remember that. Yeah.
So you would eat human, given the right opportunity.
You'd have
no sort of psychological issues about eating a human?
See, that's why I feel it's justifiable, either or. Either you eat everything or in terms of meat, or you eat nothing. And I've because I wouldn't eat certain meats, then I've moved myself into the nothing category.
That's a black and white perspective, though. And I tend to veer away from all or nothing, like to just ignore the gray.
But I think it... I don't know. I mean, it's something quite big when you're taking another living being's life. So I think it probably should be all or nothing.
Yeah, so suck on that.
Whatever. I'll suck on the cigar.
I was one of them. Like, I was someone that would never eat, you know, lamb's fry or anything, or like pig's testicle or, you know, stuff like that. And so that's why.
That's a dish?
So, well, pig's testicle. Sure you would eat bacon, but not the testicles, because that's just going a little bit.
Well, that's
low.
How I grew up. But then when I started to ask, you know, why don't I? Because I went to Vietnam and ate rat. And didn't know, and then afterwards I didn't know whether I should be feeling gross or not. But since I've been a vegetarian, I was in Japan and I did eat raw horse.
Raw horse?
Because a friend, we went to this town where it's the local delicacy and...
Get the fuck out of here.
And, they it's one of their delicacies.
Hey, they do in France too.
They do not.
They eat horse, not maybe not raw, but...
Who eats horse in France?
Are you kidding?
Our pets eat horse.
People in France have traditionally eaten horse. It's not as common, but yes.
I mean,
it's a delicacy.
The only thing I've ever read about eating horse was when Napoleon's troops were coming back from Moscow and they were starving and they were forced to eat their horses. And they all said it tasted so bad they would pour gunpowder on it to disguise the flavor. And they said it was revolting.
Well, I'm not an expert on the consumption of horse flesh in France.
But you've heard it happens?
I know it does. My dad has eaten horse
in
France. He lived there for 2.5 years.
It was kind of silvery and it was cut very finely.
Seared beef to us.
Yeah, it wasn't as tough as meat.
In France, specialized butcher shops sell horse meat, as ordinary butcher shops have been for a long time forbidden to deal in it. However, since the 1990s, it can be found in supermarket butcher shops and others. In Germany, horse meat is traditionally used in Sauerbraten, a strongly marinated type of sweet, sour, braised meat dish.
Oh, I've eaten that.
Get the fuck out of here.
I've eaten Sauerbraten, totally.
So you've eaten horse.
I don't know that there was horse in that stuff. I mean, I lived there in 97, but...
But you've eaten normal sausages in Australia? You would have eaten much worse than...
Oh, yeah, it's lips and butts. I know that. And it's disgusting. Like, I really don't like eating sausages. Ugh. And, like, I've been that way since a child. I was kind of grossed out at meat. And I do really well as a vegetarian. Like, it's not hard for me. I'm not one of those people who just crave it. Mm-hmm. But,
apparently there's an abattoir in Caboolture in Queensland that exports horse flesh to Japan and Europe.
There you go.
Australians do not generally eat horse meat, although they have a horse slaughter industry that exports to Japan and Europe.
I've eaten Australian ostrich in Seattle.
Yeah, that's because Australian ostrich or emus?
On the menu it was ostrich, but right.
We did have an ostrich farming thing that happened here in the 90s.
It was gorgeous. It was red meat. It was like a steak.
Anyway, we get off the topic of eating humans here.
I think it's the same topic, is it not? Am I totally wrong in my all or nothing?
It's an interesting point.
Well, okay. You posed me a different question, and that was, could you kill someone and eat them for $1 million? I couldn't kill anybody. Even if they consented, I just couldn't do it.
Why not?
Because if they want to die, then they have the right to take their own life. But I'm not going to be responsible for killing someone where their family and friends and close ones might suffer. And
what if there's somebody who has no family and friends? It's like a... homeless bum meth addict like Shelley.
I don't want to eat Shelley.
She didn't have much flesh on her anyway.
Let's not get into Shelley.
Okay. All right. Well, next, let's move on from cannibalism.
Blood is in the Bible.
Blood is in the book. If you don't believe me, take a fucking look.
Oh.
Bolivian.
A crazy woman we came across.
Yes. Yeah. We won't say where, because we'll frighten the horses and then have to eat them. Bolivian president blames capitalism for global warming. I tweeted this today. Bolivian president Evo Morales said capitalism is to blame for global warming and the accelerated deterioration of the planetary ecosystem.
Evo Morales.
In a speech today, opening an international conference on climate change and the rights of Mother Earth. I've been saying this for a while on the show that, you know, capitalism, as far as I can tell, is responsible for, you know, a huge amount, not just putting or keeping a large percentage of the planet's population in poverty, but for destroying much of the environment. Has been destroyed as a direct result of capitalism and consumerism in the West. Hugo, we haven't ever spoken about this. You consider yourself a capitalist? What do you think of capitalism circa April 2010, Hugo? Are you a fan?
I just like politics. This is where I kind of stay out of conversations because I seem to sit flip pretty easily. Like on this, I'm not all or nothing. Capitalism, like I'm a big proponent. I think, I don't know, capitalism comes with, you know, freedom and all that sort of stuff. It's kind of an extension, isn't it?
Why?
Isn't it, you know, just civil liberties and all that sort of stuff? Isn't capitalism just an economic form of civil liberty?
No.
No.
No?
Capitalism
isn't
synonymous with democracy.
No.
No, but it's capitalism's, everyone's, you know, right and ability to, you know, to use commerce to their own will, and I guess, and then they become a drop in the ocean of everyone else doing the same thing. Isn't it kind of just, I don't know, like do we even have, yeah, I don't know. See, this is where I can't form a coherent opinion. Because there's just so much to it.
Well, it's a complex subject.
Yeah,
I was about to say. I mean, it's.
Can you define capitalism as against other things then? I mean, what's the opposite of capitalism?
Well, communism
or
socialism. And, you know, in our country, in the United States, there's no example of pure capitalism anywhere on the planet.
Yeah.
I mean, capitalism essentially is where everything is available to be bought and sold.
Well, and I think the U.S. is the closest to pure capitalism that we have on this earth.
Pure in a pure laissez-faire capitalist society, you would be able to buy humans. Because everything is a commodity in a capitalist society. Yeah. And the people
was that way in the U.S.
Yeah. And the people with the capital essentially have the power of the means of production. You know, they're able to buy anything and everything. And everything is for sale. Everything is for trade. You know, obviously, in our country, in the United States, we have a hybrid of capitalism and socialism where some things are available to be bought, but we also have a certain level of a welfare system and protection to regulate excesses of human greed. You know, we've just seen one of the examples of how human greed can have a cataclysmic effect. You know, the GFC, and thank you to the Wall Street bankers and the big corporations that were running on massive debts. But, you know, one of the things that the debates I always get into, and I got into it, nearly got into one of these on Twitter today, somebody who runs a Twitter account called Kids for Cat, or Capitalism for Kids, I think, replied to me that capitalism is the best form of economic system ever invented, and linked through to a website that gave a fairly simplistic and naive description of capitalism, which I can read to you, actually. Take this nub of a cigar while I look for this.
That could have sounded dirty.
Everything I say usually sounds dirty.
Kind of, yeah.
So this is a post on a website called Conservative Economics. Why capitalism is the best economic system? It says capitalism is an economic system based on private ownership in which activities are primarily determined by the function of a free market rather than by central government planning. When I speak of capitalism, I'm referring to what is known as laissez-faire, which means allowed to do. In other words, an economy with little government intervention. The US is currently under a system known as a mixed economy, which is basically a mixture of capitalism and socialism. And here's the crux. He says, capitalism works well because of the way it deals with self-interest, distributes limited resources, grows standards of living, and provides incentives for excellence. Now, I used to be a big Hugo's taking photos. I used to be a big proponent of – don't get embarrassed. I used to be a big proponent of capitalism too in my 20s because I believed that it was the
– Sorry, I need the light.
Yeah. It was the fairest system of human economic interaction – because it allowed everyone to earn a living based on their hard work, their effort and intelligence. However, what I didn't understand until I was in my 30s, I think, and I read a little bit more widely, is if we look at what is good for us as a society, and as a society, I mean, on a planetary level, and what's in our own best self-interest, as pro-capitalist proponents we usually say, capitalism actually doesn't seem to be in our best self-interests as a society.
Not at all. It's completely short-sighted.
Explain why.
Oh, because if we just want the rich and whomever to do whatever they want without any... ramifications. I mean, there are ramifications. That's a problem. There are environmental ramifications. There are societal ramifications. And I mean, the whole problem about capitalism is not considering a healthy society. It's all about healthy individuals and rich individuals and consumerism and excess. So a system based on consumerism and excess cannot sustain this planet. We know that.
Yeah, but I guess to understand that, you have to take a global view or a bigger view than capitalist proponents of capitalism normally do. I mean, they'll point to Australia and say, look, we're a predominantly capitalist society. Look how great we've got it compared to most countries in the world. Capitalism rocks. Or look at the United States and how, you know, there is a certain standard of living that even the lower economic components of society have.
But America is completely reliant on foreign goods, where and really, I mean, kind of slave labor, I guess. I mean, we're reliant on other poor countries.
When you say reliant on them, in what way do you mean?
I mean the standard of living. The standard of living. I mean, most things you buy in the U.S. are from third world countries, second third world countries. And so that standard of living, either, okay, if it's... If we're not reliant on second and third world countries, only the super rich can have that standard of living.
It's not even as distant as that. In one example is in the wine world is that when the governor brought in the rule in California that
Arnold
that to get a driver's license you had to be a proper citizen, all the Mexican migrants that were illegal couldn't get driver's licenses, and the meant they couldn't, the wineries couldn't function as well because all the picking, all that sort of stuff, purely migrant workers from Mexico.
Well, and so the exactly. wine industry struggled. And the agriculture industry, Americans wouldn't have the food at the markets and the grocery stores that they have without this cheap labor that, you know, are coming from Mexico and from Puerto Rico and Dominican and wherever.
What I was going to argue is that if we think about our own self-interests, I mean, most people think that when you talk about economic systems other than capitalism, it's because you're altruistic. You're trying to, you know, this idea of the bleeding heart liberal that's worried about the poor and isn't, you know, and that's a bad thing. I actually think that capitalism isn't in our own self-interest, even though short term, we have, you know, countries like Australia and the US have been able to use capitalism over the last couple of hundred years, or a version of capitalism, which is only a few hundred years old as it is, to rapidly accelerate our economies and create a certain standard of living for a lot of people. What we've now seen happen is the follow-on effects of that are that we've gone out in the name of our own greed and destroyed the environment around the planet.
Yep.
We've also destroyed people around the planet in the Middle East, in Latin America, Central America, throughout Asia, in the pursuit of our own wealth and our own standard of living. And what's starting to happen now is those things are starting to come back to bite us on the ass. We've destroyed, possibly destroyed the planet beyond repair, so we're all going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Or the people around the world that have been affected as a result of the greed of the capitalist countries and their desire for their natural resources and to take all of their wealth,
exactly,
are coming back and trying to retaliate by attacking our countries. And, you know, there's a growing discontent around the world for the greedy Western consumerist capitalist mode of living. But on the other hand, you know, the people around the world also want a better standard of living. And so, you know, there's a lot of people in China, a lot of people in India who want more, but at the same time there's a growing disaffection, but anger, I guess, towards what the West has been doing for the last couple of hundred years. And that's not a, you know, it's not a conspiracy theory. You just need to read any one of, you know, lots of books by authors like Howard Zinn or Chomsky and Edward Herman, I mean, or George Monbiot. There's plenty of hard examples out there of how Western corporations have been exploiting developing countries for centuries. I mean, this isn't a new thing. This goes back to the colonial period of the British and the Spanish in particular, who had big armadas and were able to go to South America, you know, Asia, the Middle East, Africa, India during the 18th, 19th centuries and start exploiting the natural resources of those countries. And it hasn't stopped. And it's coming back to bite us on the ass.
It's built on the model of exploitation.
It's built on the model of greed.
Greed.
We want what they have. We have more power than they have, so we're going to go take it.
And so they're going to exploit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Natural resources, people, whatever.
Yeah.
But that's been going on. I mean, if you look at serfdom, like there were people, small minority exploiting a larger group, living lavishly, and it kept the bigger group down in, you know, in poverty. And all this is just, if anything, it's made it a more sort of fair system in that anyone can now become that lord and they just have to find their own people to make their serfs.
Wage slaves.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I like to think of this outside of our own small geographical boundaries. We need to look at it, I think, on a global basis and the effects of this capitalist mode globally. I tend to agree with Morales that capitalism has destroyed the planet.
I think so.
Whereas,
I completely agree.
You know, countries like that have a socialist or communist economic philosophy that don't allow people to just buy whatever they want or have whatever they want, but are more interested in living simply, living sustainably.
Yeah.
You know, consequently have done a lot less damage, I think, to the environment, to the planet as a whole.
It's more about local sustainability. Can they sustain themselves in their own locale, in their own country? And they're not going to cheaply compromise. I mean, Cuba could bow down to the United States, but they're not going to compromise, and they're trying to sustain themselves in a moral, well, I don't know about moral, but yeah, more locally sustainable model.
I'm not, you know, and I'm sure that they didn't go into socialism or communism necessarily with a view towards sustainability, because it wasn't as much an issue 50 years ago, you know, 80 years ago, when the first so-called communist and socialist experiments started to happen.
Right.
Although I would argue that we probably haven't got any good historical example of communism or socialism either. I mean, people normally point to the USSR and China as the big examples of communism, but they weren't communist at all. They were autocratic central systems of, you know, control. By the very definition of communism, the commune, the workers own everything and control everything. And we've seen very few examples of that on a large scale anywhere ever globally.
Right.
All right. Well, that's that story. And Hugo's ticking away.
Making everybody nervous.
Really?
I'm not nervous.
Because the microphone doesn't do that.
Right.
The Vatican blames child sex scandals on gay priests. This is a good story in the last week. The Vatican has apparently distanced itself eventually from remarks made by the top prelate, Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone. Said it is homosexuality, not celibacy, that is to blame for the child abuse in the church.
Right.
He said that many psychologists and psychiatrists have shown that there is no link between celibacy and pedophilia, but many others have shown, and I've been told recently, that there is a relationship between homosexuality and pedophilia. That is the truth. I read it in a document written by psychologists.
Oh, he read it somewhere, therefore it's true.
I read it on the interwebs. He didn't actually go to say who
these
psychologists were, where he'd read it. But, you know, yet again, our friends the Catholics just cannot take any form of responsibility for their behaviour. And again, as I've
they
always...
They have never done so.
No, yeah, go back to bloody hell, the Inquisitions and and beyond. And the point that never or rarely gets raised in the press when this comes up, to what the Catholics try and do is... say, oh, it's just a small number of bad egg priests that are causing this. Where the real issue, in my mind, isn't that there have been priests that have been abusing children, whilst that's bad enough as it is. The bigger issue is how the Vatican deliberately and knowingly, and as an act of Vatican policy that came down from a pope in the early 60s, was... a deliberate effort to hide these acts when they were discovered.
Yeah,
deal with them internally. Well, they've admitted to it, but it never gets talked about, or rarely gets talked about in the press when this comes up. Because that's the big issue was, and this is why Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens are trying to sue the Pope. They're trying to arrest the Pope, have him arrested, actually.
Well, next time he lands in the UK.
Yeah, they want to have him arrested. Yeah.
And as well he should be, as should George W. Bush, and as should anybody who commits these horrific crimes.
Obama?
Yeah.
You want to see Obama arrested?
I don't, because he has a nice smile, but... No.
Seriously, if there was a petition to arrest Obama,
okay,
would you sign it?
If people are...
Considering you voted
for him? If pot smokers are being arrested for possession of pot, white-collar criminals should be, too.
Arrested for pot?
No, for arrested for whatever white-collar crimes that they commit. I mean, come on. What are pot smokers doing except for eating munchies?
Smoking.
Smoking. And they're eating junk food. And listening to, like, I don't know, CCR. Yeah.
Creating art.
Yeah, yeah. Creating art, listening to CCR. Do you know CCR?
Yes.
Okay. You looked at me like, what?
I'm still trying to figure out your analogy between arresting the Pope and pot smokers, but
well, okay, anybody who is committing crimes, especially horrific crimes, I'm saying pot smokers shouldn't be arrested, but they are, and white collar crimes, and I guess what do you call this type of crime?
Crimes committed under the banner of religion.
Yeah,
Hugo, we're rabid atheists. I'm not sure where you stand on these things. What do you think about arresting the Pope?
I have no opinion on that because I've only just heard of the whole
possibility. Come on.
I have opinions on how the Catholic Church engenders pedophilia in priests and that sort of thing. And I don't think it's purely homosexuality.
Of course it's not.
These are young men taken out of the market, I guess, at their sexual prime and put in, you know, when they're... Well, previously, I don't know how it's done at the moment, but, traditionally, to become a priest, you'd finish school and go into school to become a priest. And so you're taken out of... In your sexual prime, you're taken out of that that whole scene. And then you spend 20 years... You know, being told not to have sexual thoughts, and then I don't know. All of a sudden,
it festers.
Yeah, and you take it out on the innocent.
Well, and here's
it's not so much that they're just young boys, but I guess traditionally that's the most. It's kind of like opportunistic crime, possibly, in that they're the people that the priests have exposure to, the young boys in doing whatever jobs they do at the church.
Well, and here's what I think about. Particularly the priests that have created crimes or have committed crimes. Who wants to be a priest? Everybody wants to have sex. We're animals. We want to have sex. Well, what if you are homosexual? And this is my strong premonition, is that anybody who was gay in the 50s to... 90s, really, and was to come out about it, that's just social suicide. That's suicide socially, in your own family, in your community, whatever.
So why not find a job where you don't have to have people constantly asking why don't you have a wife?
Exactly.
Well, I'm a priest, and I get a good job, I get a house, and a paycheck.
So I do think that there are probably a lot of homosexual priests out there. Is homosexuality the cause of committing crimes, or is it sexual repression?
Yeah, and but it's not always on boys either. It's on girls as well. So I don't think it is strictly homosexual.
Well, and I mean, priests have, I think, more contact with boys. Catholic priests have more access to boys and.
I guess they would have no knowledge of a female body. I mean, it would be totally foreign to them. So they might target, that might scare them. I mean, they've probably always felt that they should fear a naked female form.
Well,
so maybe they go for boys.
Yeah, I don't know. I think a lot of them are, closet homosexuals who never had the environment where they could be open and comfortable with their sexuality and express their sexuality. But there's also, I think there's just an issue of availability. I mean, look at prisons, and that's, yeah. I think that's a little bit different. I mean, there's always, rapes happening and there's a lot of messed up stuff that goes on. Again, and a lot of that is, it's opportunistic. And I don't think that that's really a good parallel, prisons and religious environments, but I think the issue that you're talking about, Cameron, is how the Catholic Church is dealing with it now. It happened regardless of why or how, and it still happens, I'm sure, why or how. But your main issue is, what are they doing? I mean, they have, this is 2010, right? They have a responsibility to own up to the crimes of the past, to live in this century, to stop thinking that everyone's just going to, you know, like in past centuries, just bow down to them because God's on their side. That's not the case anymore.
But isn't it just a financial, like a business and marketing reaction now? I mean, to come out and admit all of it would be a huge marketing issue.
Well, but what about their members? I mean, they're members of the Catholic Church who are really disturbed about this. And they're disturbed that they're not handling it in the right way. I'm sure they're losing members right and left. But I don't know. Somehow they're trying to save face, and they're not doing it well.
Yeah, I mean, my issue with this has always been that the policy of the Vatican, its instructions to, you know, the archbishops all around the world has been, and the cardinals, has been to systematically hide anytime there's an accusation of any impropriety on behalf of a priest, that they're to deal with it internally. And it's basically a system of confession or internal counseling that the priest goes through. And then they're moved on to another community where they can do it all over again.
Yeah.
Now, this is, I mean, we're not talking about this happening in the 12th century. We're talking about this happening the end of the 20th century. And you know, as far as we know, it's still happening. There's been a systematic approach by the Vatican to cover this stuff up and allow it to continue.
That's right.
And that's just not acceptable. Any other business, and that's what, you know, the Vatican is, it's a business, that was involved in this sort of large-scale suppression of evidence and, you know, enabling criminals to continue to molest children.
What if that were to happen?
Would be shut down.
Right, in the education system. There's a teacher known to molest students.
Mm.
What would happen? They'd be shut down immediately. They would not be allowed to go back and they would be in jail. They'd be in prison.
Yeah, but the Catholics try and get away with it by saying, well, you know, we deal with our own problems internally. And you know, Dawkins and Hitchens' position is, well, the Pope is the head of state, and a head of state can be arrested on crimes against humanity.
Yeah. Mm.
Hugo? Stop taking photos and talking. Come on. Put it out there. What do you think of the Catholics?
He's got a gorgeous camera.
It is a lovely camera. It's amazing.
You could do a great violin, too.
Thank you.
You want to trade?
Mine's more expensive.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
It's a huge issue. I'd love to see, I can't wait to see it played out, though.
That's what we're talking about,
issues. I know. Well,
come on, step up, man.
You almost need to, you know, take 10 podcasts and just focusing on each individual bit.
But you can have an opinion. Like, I am just angered by everything. Like, my initial reaction is just anger and not, but, and especially since they brought the gay thing into it, that just, I mean, without that, it's just a mind-blowing, stupid operation that they're running. And then they say, they try to blame it on homosexuality.
But even
that homosexuality has an innate, homosexuals have an innate flaw.
And even if there was a legitimate link between homosexuality and pedophilia, which I don't believe there's any research that I've seen that backs that up. But even if that was the case, that's not the issue. The issue is that they've been, hiding these guys and suppressing the evidence and moving them on and allowing them to commit crimes again. They're not facing up to their responsibility to having done that. I mean, they're being forced to by countries like Ireland, which had this massive investigation over 10 years, but we haven't had one in the United States. We're not going to have one in Australia because all of our heads of government are Christian fundamentalists and will not tackle religion at all. Even the Scientologists, they won't touch there because they know it's a slippery slope. Moving on.
I do have an opinion. That's
all right.
Hang on.
You guys got an opinion.
Well, the topic is so broad, but the one thing I am sure about is that I don't get too angry at those heads of state because it's all the it's everyone else, you know, it's the masses that allow the whole system to work, and so they're the ultimate responsibility.
They control the masses. Are you kidding?
Well, the masses are free. They're allowed, you know, they've allowed themselves to be controlled.
They're brainwashed, dude.
Yeah, but I mean, you can get out of that. I used to go to church back in, you know, teenage years, and I got out of it. I mean, that's the ultimate responsibility is the people attending church, the people who like to have a priest that isn't married because he's devoted to God. Isn't that good? He's devoted to God. He doesn't have a wife. You know, I want to go listen to him because he must know what he's talking about. He, you know, that's his shtick. So it's all, I mean, that's where it ultimately falls to those people.
The government they deserve.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah, I used to agree with that, but I agree with what Chrissy is saying. I mean, we live in a country where people have been brainwashed since birth. You know, we live in a country where we think we're free, but we have an incredibly sophisticated propaganda system that is run by and in the interests of a fairly small group of wealthy individuals who control the media. And from the day we're born till the day we die, we are saturated with TV, radio, print, and now web and movies that are conditioning us to think certain ways about certain subjects. Well, the advertisements come in all of those things that I mentioned. You know?
And we
are hit with blanket propaganda pushing certain ideas and ideologies from the day we're born. And, yes, people can break out of that, and that's why I do a podcast to try and help people break out of it. But that was in there.
But people even choose by choosing their propaganda source. I mean, you've got Catholics, you've got Anglicans, you've got all these other things. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, I'm sure people grow up Catholic and end up Anglican and all that sort of stuff. So they're obviously making choices here and there, and they're just not, why don't they go the full step and extricate themselves fully?
Because we're in the society we're in. Like, so I left the Mormon church and I knew that that wasn't right, but where did I turn to first? I was like, well, what other kind of Christian church? I wasn't thinking through the whole Christianity thing, and I went through that whole path, and here I am at the end. I'm an atheist. Mm. I went through that whole process, but it is a process, and to go through that whole process is to go against the grain of the society that's so deeply ingrained in all of us and all around us. It's like, I don't know what your religious beliefs are, but, you know, do you do the whole Christmas thing?
I like Festivus.
I do too. I do too. And Christmas to me here was weird. It was all warm and everything. And I generally like Christmas because it's like cold and I like the food and the drink and the lights. And it's like a winter solstice.
Yeah. But that's all celebration. All humans like a bit of celebration.
Right. But
most Australians are just cultural religious people. They do Easter. They might go to church at Easter and Christmas. And so,
why?
They're kidding themselves.
They're kidding themselves, but it's so hard to make that break because we're so brainwashed and because all of society is on this track.
It's the easy option. I mean, they want to be all hedonistic and then think that they can get out of it by going to church one day a year. It doesn't... Yeah, they're just taking the easy option, so I can't get past the fact that a lot of it falls back to the individual.
It does, but I'm just trying to illustrate that the individual is been given a lobotomy.
Mm. Sheeple.
Yeah.
Herd of sheeple. Moving on. I was one of the listeners to the Napoleon show, one of the new listeners, sent me an American, of course, sent me a nasty email the other day telling me that he liked the show, but I should leave my politics out of it because it makes me look stupid. And we were sort of having an email back and forwards, and he said, well, you know, I think this was on a show I recorded a few years ago, and he said, because, you know, I said something about how the Iraq war wasn't going very well. Now how stupid do you look? And so I did some numbers, and I said, well, look, I still think the Iraq war isn't going very well. Number one, it's an illegal invasion. It's not a war.
That's right.
But secondly, and I did some numbers, according to one of the sites that tracks civilian deaths in Iraq, since the US-led invasion in 2003, there's been something like an average of 14,000 civilians a year die in Iraq. It's about roughly about 100,000. The estimate's between 95 and 105,000 civilians over the 7 years. During Saddam Hussein's 25, 30-year reign of Iraq, it is estimated by the United States that about 300,000 civilians were murdered, which equates to about 12,000 civilians a year on average. So there are more civilians dying in Iraq since the American-led invasion and they got rid of Saddam than were dying in Iraq during Saddam's, you know, brutal reign. Do you think the people of Iraq are better off now than they were before or not?
No.
Do you think they were better off under Saddam?
Well, I've read and watched documentaries and so forth that the civilians are saying, no, we're definitely better off with Saddam. Like, the civilians are saying this. So, I mean... the U.S. can say whatever they want to. They can say we're bringing democracy to the people. They can say whatever they want to. But the truth is I think they're more afraid of American military than they are, Iraqi military under Saddam.
Of course, we saw via WikiLeaks the collateral murder video. You guys seen the collateral murder video yet?
No. Mm-hmm.
This was something that WikiLeaks broke about a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago now. There's footage from something that happened in 2007. A couple of them, like an American helicopter. Hello, little possum walking along our deck. They're like a Black Hawk or one of these choppers, spotted a group of people in Iraq, thought that they had weapons, and that this chopper was like, you know, a kilometer away, was looking through a bloody infrared camera.
I do know about this, yeah.
Thought that they had weapons, thought one of them had an RPG. Now, these people weren't attacking the helicopter, didn't even know it was there. You can see in the video. And the helicopter got permission from their headquarters to basically wipe them out. So they started, you know, shooting them and, you know, sending missiles at them and shit. And then they killed or injured all of this group of seven or eight people. And then a minute or two later, a van turned up to take the dead and the injured away, and the helicopter blew the van up as well. Now, it turns out that the original group were a couple of Reuters journalists, and what the chopper thought was an RPG was a camera with a telephoto lens on it, and the rest were a bunch of civilians helping the photographers and the journalists get around. The van that came to pick them up contained two children, which the helicopter then blew up. So it was a bunch of civilians, and the Pentagon has been hiding this. They admitted finally to the fact that there was a couple of journalists involved, but they said they were like collateral damage by innocent bystanders. Reuters has been trying to get the truth about what happened for 3 years. Pentagon said they did an internal inquiry and proper procedures were followed and it was all above board. Then finally, obviously, somebody, a whistleblower inside of the Pentagon or inside of the US military somewhere leaked this video to WikiLeaks and they put it online. This is one incident that we found out about where civilians just got killed for no reason. It must happen all the time. And obviously a lot of the civilians getting killed, they're being killed by Iraqis that are, you know, in the only way that they can, protesting the occupying force that's in their country by car bombs and roadside bombs and all these sorts of things. And there are Iraqi civilians dying as well. But whether they're dying at the hands of the US-led military occupation or dying at the hands of civilians as a result of the US military occupation doesn't really matter. I mean, it's the occupation that is driving this behavior.
That's
and
right.
There are more people. There's like 10% more civilians dying per annum in Iraq now than there was under Saddam Hussein's regime. And, I mean, when are we going to take responsibility for what our countries are doing in this part of the world? Finally, last story and we'll shut up. Every black hole contains another universe. This is something that I've been talking about for years, but apparently the astrophysicists have just started to wake up and agree with me. This is in National Geographic. It says, like part of a cosmic Russian doll, our universe may be nested inside a black hole that is itself part of a larger universe. In turn, all the black holes found so far in our universe, from the microscopic to the supermassive, may be doorways into alternate realities. According to a mind-bending new theory, a black hole is actually a tunnel between universes, a type of wormhole. The matter the black hole attracts doesn't collapse into a single point, as had been predicted, but rather gushes out a white hole at the other end of the black one, the theory goes. Now, this was in a recent paper published by Indiana University physicist Nikodem Popolowski, and I reckon he's been listening to this show, because remember when we were talking about, on the last podcast, we were talking about the Large Hadron Collider and how it created all these black holes. What did I say?
Yeah.
I said we just created, you know, a billion new universes that have gone out into their own time-space dimensions. I mean, that's always made sense
we
to me.
Gods,
that that's what
then. The Mormons are right. We can all become gods.
I think we talked about this in the last episode. But, I mean, it's always made a lot of sense to me that that's what a black hole is. If all of this mass is getting sucked into the black hole, that it's creating its own universe somewhere.
Wrote it out somewhere.
So, you know, our Big Bang event was the create. I mean, black holes, we think. The theory is today that black holes are created by a collapsing supermassive star. So our Big Bang event, you know, people always say, well, where did the Big Bang come from?
That was the white
Big
hole.
Bang skeptics.
Am I getting this right? The Big Bang was the white hole.
Yeah,
it could have been
was the collapse of a supermassive star in another universe that created our universe.
Could have been a few ETs like in a laboratory somewhere.
Yes. I like that theory as well. I don't give it much credence, but I like the idea that, you know, scientists deliberately created our universe somewhere, and when we finally figure out the code that's hidden in string theory, it'll say, hello, my name's Jim, and this is universe attempt 4,369. Call me on this number if you get this message.
Maybe
this is a high score.
If he's our God.
Yeah, high score. Yes. It's an Xbox game somewhere in another universe. The objective of the game is to create a universe that spawns a sentient species that finally works out the code to the universe. When you do that, you win. Yeah. It's a reality show in another universe. He hasn't been evicted yet.
It's like, have you seen Watchmen?
Love Watchmen.
When Dr. Manhattan at the end says, I think I might go off and create some species, create some life.
Yeah. You have complete control over matter. You can...
Yeah.
Do anything.
Yeah.
I mean, I just love the idea that with the LHC experiment a couple of weeks ago, we created a bunch of new universes. And many of them might have collapsed because they didn't produce a system of physics that was sustainable. Hmm. I mean, our universe, as far as we can tell, you know, has just lucked into the fact that we have all of the right constants, that it's been able to sustain itself for 14, 15 billion years, but it's quite possible. Like, life may have formed on other planets but never really gotten off the ground because it didn't form in a way that was sustainable as it did on this planet.
Mm. Like a newborn. You know, some newborns just have no hope.
Yeah, they don't have the right...
Their systems aren't all...
Lungs and heart and stuff like that, yeah. But so there you go. That's what happened. That's what the Big Bang is. When anyone asks you, well, what caused the Big Bang, you can say a black hole in another universe. Why?
Well, the science doesn't... It points towards that.
It's a theory.
Yeah.
But I like it.
Why?
So is...
What?
Just to get a good analogy. So the black hole is like someone's mouth and the white hole...
Could, yeah, right.
With an analogy like that, you've got a career in the media, man. That's about
it's going to be like Morning Show with Hugo on X radio station.
I'll have to have my morning cigar.
Yeah, right. That would be a good radio show. Morning Cigar with Hugo.
Well, I need to get some of these physicists on that are talking about this. Another physicist, Andreas Albrecht, physicist at the University of California, says, saying our universe was created by a gush of matter from a parent universe simply shifts the original creation event into an alternate reality. In other words, it doesn't explain how the parent universe came to be or why it has the properties it has, properties our universe presumably inherited. I don't know why.
Was it the chicken or the egg?
It's universes all the way back. Who created the first universe?
Yeah.
Yeah. To be explained on the next podcast. I think that's enough for tonight. Thank you, Hugo, for joining us in this
pleasure
podcast. Thank you, Chrissy D.
You're always welcome.
We're off to Bundaberg tomorrow for 3 days with the kiddies. No, no, Saturday, not tomorrow. We'll go for Saturday. Are you excited about going to Bundaberg, the hub of culture in Australia? Yeah, we're going to take some cigars.
I hope.
We've only got a couple left. We might have to stock up before we go.
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Thanks for listening, folks. This is Cameron out.
Yo, I have to pee, yo.